Good morning, everyone. Once again, we're delighted to be sitting here in Pasadena. The cases will be called in the order listed on the docket. The first case on calendar for argument is Madero versus McLane Food Service. Counsel for appellant, please approach and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Glenn Danis from Clarkson Law Firm for appellants. So the Motor Carrier Act exempts from the FLSA's overtime requirements employees who meet several criteria. Only whether interstate commerce is involved is the only element at issue in this case. This court has applied the exemption to purely intrastate transport of goods under certain circumstances. Those circumstances are highly fact-specific and ad hoc. The district court here erred by failing to conclude that transport of goods from McLane's warehouse to hundreds of fast food restaurants was intrastate for three main reasons. First, under binding precedent, because no intrastate destination was identified beyond the Riverside Distribution Center or specific customers known and identified when the intrastate journey began, the specific journeys from warehouse to customers were intrastate. This is Watkins' sentence two. McLane was purchasing goods from interstate suppliers for its own resale and storing them for convenience at its warehouse unless and until it sold the goods to intrastate restaurants. Second, if there were any doubt, other undisputed evidence supports this. One, title transfers to McLane at the warehouse. Two, the interstate transport is pursuant to separate contracts between McLane and its own suppliers, which McLane failed to bring into evidence. Number three, McLane uses its own transport only after receiving goods from the warehouse. Four, the goods are placed in McLane's general inventory, and five, goods are fungible within each restaurant chain. Third, the contract between McLane and the customer brand representative cannot provide the missing intent for the continuation of interstate transport beyond the warehouse. The district court erred by reading the exemption far too capaciously based on a misapplication of circuit and Supreme Court precedent and should be reversed. On the first point that there
Counsel,
is no-
can state- I ask, so this case seems to me very close to Klitsky in the sense that in Klitsky you had, out-of-state vendors who brought it into a warehouse and there were prearranged customer orders, and that warehouse was just a temporary stop before ultimately getting to the customers. The main difference is that here defendants are using a kind of predictive model for their for their chain restaurants, but the goods are coming from out of state. They're going into the warehouse. They're being segmented for the different chains, and then they move on to the customers. And in Klitsky, we found that that was the last leg of a journey to make it interstate. Why do you think that's not the applicable case in our view?
Yeah, so your Honor's point about the difference is all the difference. This case is actually much more like Southern Pack or Standard Oil, and the big difference is the lack of orders. In Klitsky, there were orders in hand. If there were orders in hand for specific customers, for specific amounts, and at specific destinations, at the time the interstate transport started, this would be Klitsky and we would lose.
Does it change the fact that the vendors have their own separate contracts with the chain restaurants themselves, that the distribution agreements that say, hey, McLane's going to do this and we're on board?
Well, first of all, those aren't in evidence. And second of all, I was just going to say that in Southern Pack, this court said the expectation is simply not sufficient. In fact, in that case, it said, while it's true that nearly all the canned goods shipped to the warehouse eventually moved interstate and to foreign destinations, that expectation is not sufficient to supply the requisite fixed and persisting transportation intent at the time of shipment. And again, that's Standard Oil as well. 95% of the fuel oil was known to go to very particular customers, but because it was a requirements contract and it was supposed to be provided as needed rather than filling specific orders had in hand at the time of interstate transport, that was found to be intrastate. That is all the difference, the fact that there are no pre-existing orders identifying specific customers. And again, that's the difference between the Jacksonville paper special order versus Jacksonville paper other. Jacksonville paper made this specific differentiation between those that were ordering per special orders or the equivalent of it. Here, the contracts that are actually, or the only contract that's actually in evidence, is essentially with an umbrella organization for the different chains that is an exclusivity agreement, basically. It provides some details regarding pricing and says that McLane is supposed to have a certain amount of goods in order to meet future needs. That there are no orders in that contract. That contract, in fact, also says that at 1295E in the record, that there is supposed to be a future agreement. There are supposed to be future contracts between McLane and the suppliers. And those are the agreements that actually would be the ones governing the interstate transport. And those are not in evidence for reasons I don't know, but those were not submitted. So the only contract we have here is sort of this master-seller agreement, which is not the sorts of orders that we're talking about in cases like Klitsky.
Now, would you agree if the out-of-state vendors, if McLane were not the intermediary that it is, and the out-of-state vendors had direct contracts with the chains and were just shipping things over, and rather than stopping off at a Riverside warehouse, but to their stores, that would clearly be interstate. Is that right?
Yes.
So the controlling variable in your view is the fact that there's not prearranged customer orders between McLane and the chains, and that this predictive model still allows for some uncertainty as to whether things would be sold to the chain restaurants?
The predictive model is really just the old cases with some better technology. It's basically saying this is Standard Oil or this is Southern Pack with slightly better predictions and slightly better technology. But the missing orders are all the difference.
Okay.
There were distribution agreements, right, between McLane and the other chain vendors?
There were supposed to be agreements between McLane and the chain vendors. Yes, the Sabras.
Are you saying there were not distribution agreements?
Well, there was an exclusivity agreement that was signed that between McLane and the organization that bargains on behalf of the chains. Yes.
But are you saying that there were no distribution agreements between McLane and the restaurants?
I'm sorry, could you repeat
that? There were no distribution agreements between McLane and the restaurants?
What we have in evidence is the master service agreement. And mm-hmm. This is the only contract that's in evidence in the record. The master service agreement covers a lot of topics, but none of them are orders.
Does it cover distribution at all?
It does. It covers certain aspects of distribution for sure.
And does it cover distribution to other states?
I don't believe it is California specific. So I believe it's supposed to be just for those chains and McLane in general.
Wherever located,
yes, Your Honor.
Why doesn't that, the distribution to other states, sort of inform that this is an interstate arrangement going on, that McLane is doing this through multiple states for the chain restaurants?
Well, here we're only talking about the intrastate portion of it. So I think that while there might be interstate aspects of the agreement elsewhere, that's not what's at issue in this case. Here we're only talking about the transportation from the warehouse to the customers or the restaurants.
I mean, but they're not disconnected things. I think I forgot somewhere in the record that maybe the plaintiffs asserted that over 50% of their local shipment comes from overseas products, right? I mean, doesn't the master service agreement serve as the umbrella for all these arrangements?
Well, I think it's important to get back to the text of the exemption, which talks simply about movement of goods from place in one state to place in another state. It's talking about transport of goods. It doesn't sort of assign interstate aspects to agreements. It looks at the actual transport of particular goods and says, is that transport essentially interstate? Here, you know, the default should be that it is not because it's all within California. And then the question is, was this transport pursuant to a contract for orders, essentially, for a particular transport that denotes an endpoint, a terminus? I mean, that's the issue here. The issue is, in order to hew to the language of the exemption, is it pointing out an endpoint in California?
Well, the endpoint being in California is not necessarily dispositive, because we have to look at the entire context to see whether or not it was the ultimate destination, point A to point B, was intrastate, or whether there was an interstate component and it ended up, the last stop was California. So that's what we are trying to nurse out here, is it the former or the latter?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And I guess what I'd like to impart is that in order to make that distinction and to put this into that exemption from the Motor Carrier Act, it has to be something to indicate that it was intended to be a place in a different state to a place in mm-hmm. a different state, or a place in state A to point in state B.
Interstate.
And this contract simply can't do that. The contract says that there will be new contracts that will be entered that will be the ones that will have to dictate that between McLean and the suppliers, but those are not in evidence. I mean, this contract that we have here is nothing different from the requirements contracts at issue in Standard Oil. There were contracts in Standard Oil. There were contracts that said that Standard Oil will have as much fuel oil as is needed by the customers and will continue to give it to them. And the evidence was that 95% of those fuel oil customers bought pursuant to the requirements contracts. And that was held to be insufficient because no one could say on the day of interstate transport where any particular oil was going to end up. They knew it might be with this 95% of the people, but that's not enough. It's not enough to say that there are hundreds of restaurants that through this sort of umbrella organization are tied together.
It's a little bit different, though, because oil is fungible, right? And you're dealing with a fungible product that could go to any number of places, whereas these were specialized goods for each chain restaurant, as I understand it. They're, you know, what you send to Chick-fil-A is different than what you would send to Jack in the Box or somewhere else. Doesn't that make it a little bit of a difference?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I mean, but here's the important point for fungibility, which is that this is really like the uniforms in Watkins or Klitsky, you know, or Watkins, where they talk about different sizes and they're segregated by sizes. There is some segregation here. There are five different chains or so that have different products. Some of them are proprietary, some of them are not. Some of them are simply lids that might go to anybody. Some of them are ones that are specific to particular chains, but none of them are particular to stores. In Watkins, it was the Reynolds mats that were held to be specific enough to be an order that indicated continuous transport. We don't have anything like that here. We have products that could go to one of 300 different Taco Bells, or products that could go to one of 300 different Pizza Huts. That is still fungible within that. It could be any one of several hundred different restaurants that order the products. So it's essentially fungible within each chain.
Counsel, if we disagree with you regarding the import of the predictive model, do you lose?
If Your Honor were to find that the predictive model is sufficient instead of an order, yes, we would lose.
Did you want to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Five minutes, please. Thank you.
No, you have 1 minute and 35 seconds left.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Richard Riley on behalf of McLean Food Service. I want to start with the supply contracts because my friend has caused unnecessary confusion. The supply contracts that these plaintiffs service were produced in discovery. Rather than clutter the record with a lot of contracts, we put in declarations of three of our officers, Michael Taub at 5 ER 998, Jeff Hayes at 5 ER 1010, Marcus Tibler at 5 ER 840. They describe how those contracts work and what's in them, and that's what the district court relied upon. The plaintiffs had the opportunity to use the supply contracts to create a material fact dispute if they believed that there was anything inaccurate. They had discovery. They deposed these people. And the district court found at footnote 3 of its decision that they failed. They did not create a material fact dispute. The court also found that they had said in a binding stipulation and discovery that they had the information they needed and didn't need anything else, and there were no discovery violations on our part, and rejected that position. In plaintiffs' opening brief in this court, they said nothing about this issue at all. They have a brief reference to it in their reply brief, and now we hear it at oral argument. It's too little, too late. The supply contracts described in the declarations provide practical continuity from out-of-state suppliers through McLean and on to restaurants whose prior contracts, as described in the declarations, are being filled. Jacksonville Paper is the starting place. The case did not describe two categories, as my friend mistakenly described, but three. The first category was special orders. My friend is correct that special orders are sufficient, but they're not necessary because Jacksonville Paper also described a second category, prior contracts pursuant to which orders are made. And I'll just read the decision, what it had to say about that. The contract or understanding pursuant to which goods are ordered, like a special order, indicates where it was intended that the interstate movement should terminate. That's our case. We have contracts between McLean and the franchise, which also binds the restaurant to buy exclusively from McLean, and McLean is bound to buy from specific suppliers. There are also contracts between the franchise and the suppliers to supply to McLean for franchises. That means that when a supplier takes a good pursuant to an order from McLean, it puts it in a box, and the box has the label, Chick-fil-A, Buffalo Wild Wings, Taco Bell, or so forth, on the box. As it's sent into California, it is therefore known which franchise restaurants will receive that good when it comes into the state, and that's what Watkins tells us is the relevant inquiry. It's also known, of course, from McLean, because McLean is making the orders pursuant to the contracts that I just described that are tied to a franchise. It is true that the special orders often come later, but Jacksonville Paper said that doesn't matter. And it has to be right on that because there's a commercial reality here. If an enterprise cannot be run where an order comes from a chain restaurant to a warehouse and then the order goes out to a supplier, perhaps across the country, to bring chicken in to meet that order. This needs to be done on a much faster basis so that these restaurants have continued inventory. So there's a commercial reality, and Jacksonville Paper recognizes that. And that's why it says a contract pursuant to which the orders are made satisfies the standard, creates the practical continuity.
So that I understand your point, this predictive model aspect then doesn't seem to be dispositive in your mind. It's the separate contracts and the model itself is just supplying ongoing demand to the chains pursuant to these separate contracts.
The contracts are my stronger point, but we have both. There's a third category in Jacksonville Paper which does talk about predictive modeling, expectations of a stable group of customers. And Jacksonville Paper actually said that that can be practical continuity, but it depends on the facts of the case. In Jacksonville Paper, there wasn't enough specificity of how that worked for the predictions alone to satisfy it. Here we do have a lot more specificity about how the predictive modeling works and what our folks at McLean are looking at and making these orders. And so we could actually win under the third category in Jacksonville Paper based on the evidence. But the second category is just a lot easier because once you have that contract that's linking all of these groups, you have an integrated supply chain, which is what the 10th Circuit described in the Brock versus Flower Foods Section 1 FAA case that the Supreme Court affirmed. They talked about a continuous supply chain, an integrated chain, where the plaintiff was a last mile driver within that chain. That's exactly what we have here. This case is also identical to Carmona Mendoza, the Domino's Pizza case from this circuit, which rejects all of the arguments explicitly that my friend just made. In that case, the goods are coming from out of state to a warehouse that services Domino's pizza franchises. There are no special orders when it comes into the state. This court said that didn't matter. There's still practical continuity under Jacksonville paper, the same standard that applies here. It also said it didn't matter that they don't know which specific restaurant will get it when it comes in. It's going to a Domino's Pizza. That means that there's a continuity. The intent of all parties concerned, the supplier, the distributor, and the restaurants, is that it will end up at a place other than the warehouse. Additionally, we have several cases from around the country that reject my friend's argument. Foxworthy versus Highland Dairy, the 10th Circuit, held that shipments to a warehouse to service Circle K convenience stores in Oklahoma were established a practical continuity within the meaning of Jacksonville paper, even though it wasn't known which Circle K convenience store it would go to. In Collins versus Heritage Wine Cellars, 3/4 of the wine that Heritage brought into the country to be in an Illinois warehouse wasn't even set for a specific chain. It was set for a stable group of buyers. It wasn't known which one it would be. They stayed there for about a month. Here, our products, on average, and this again is undisputed, stay in our warehouse for about 13 days. For perishable items, it's 2 to 7 days. This is a very short period of time compared to Heritage Wine Cellars. Yet Judge Posner in Collins says, because it's a short period, it's a month, because you have a stable group, it's based on forecasting, there's no repackaging, no even aging of the wine, nothing like that. That's practical continuity. In Ash versus Flower Foods, the Fifth Circuit, looking at the same Flower Foods model that the Supreme Court addressed recently, said that that's practical continuity, even though, and I'm quoting, flowers did not know at the time of production which customers would ultimately receive which goods. It knew that the products were shipped into Louisiana for distribution to Louisiana customers, end quote. That's just like our case. Mena versus MacArthur Dairy from the 11th Circuit has a similar fact pattern. The orders there are based on projected needs in a warehouse. None of these cases have said that there has to be an order in hand. None of them have said we have to know the exact address. It's a subset of places. The box has the label. It's a short period of time. There's no material dispute of fact on any of those issues.
Were you going to address your cross appeal about the jurisdiction?
I'm happy to address. I want to make sure there's no questions on the appeal. The cross appeal, the district court was too hasty in rejecting our position under traditional diversity jurisdiction, violated circuit precedent in analyzing our estimate of attorney fees. It didn't address CAFA jurisdiction at all, and I'll address each of these in order. First of all, the district court appeared to believe that it was the plaintiff's role to establish diversity jurisdiction and not our role, but the case law, including the Royal Canin decision, makes clear that we have the prerogative to establish that. The district court rejected our attorney fee estimate not based on circuit precedent, for which directs that the lodestar approach in lodestar states be applied, but rather it eyeballed the attorney fees against the amount of recovery of damages that we estimated and simply said it thought it was too high. This court rejected that approach in Fritch and said that courts are directed to apply the lodestar approach, which is what we did. We took a reasonable rate, which the plaintiffs have not contested, against a reasonable number of hours that we supported with evidence and provided our estimate of attorney fees. So the court did not do the correct analysis there. At a minimum, it can't be affirmed. I recognize the court's usual practice would be to vacate and remand on that. I note we put the arguments for this court where it could reach the issue if it so chose in its discretion. And here the plaintiffs haven't argued against most of anything that we have said. They've simply said that they think this case will settle, but they're not looking at it from the right time frame. At the time this case was filed, which Royal Canin at footnote 8 says remains the temporal framework for the amount of controversy. At the time it was filed, this was a class action. It was a serious case. The idea that nuisance money would send it away is completely fanciful. At least it's speculative. And all we have to do to estimate attorney fees is put in a reasonable estimate. We don't have to have a crystal ball, know exactly what's going to happen. We put forward a reasonable estimate.
Let me ask about that. I mean, the district court said that that McLean was unreasonable because it was assuming 100% violations. Why do you disagree with that?
It doesn't work for a couple of reasons. One, it doesn't actually matter because once you add the attorney fees with the waiting time penalties, even if the court disagreed with 100% on some of the other points, which I'll get to, we would still cross $75,000. The waiting time penalties have to be 100% because that's just a daily calculation. They get 30 days wages, and they're alleged a 30-day violation. So that is justified as 100%. You add that to the attorney fees, we're over $75,000. I do think that 100% was legitimate here because of the type of violations that were described in the complaint, which is where we go to make a fair estimate. There are two basic concepts. One was that these drivers have to do work before and after they get out of the truck, but the time clock is in the truck. And so they're saying they're working before they're clocking in. And I don't see how that could happen sometimes and not others. The time clock is in the truck. So that's not changing on a day-to-day basis. So 100% is reasonable. They also say that during meal breaks, they are on call. As a matter of policy, whether they actually have to do any work on meal breaks isn't the point. The complaint is very clear about that. It says they're on call as a matter of policy. That, again, is going to be the case across the board. So 100% is justified on that basis as well. As I said, we don't need it. Under the Class Action Fairness Act, this case might actually be more straightforward because all parties agree under circuit precedent there is jurisdiction under the Class Action Fairness Act. United Steel against Shell Oil makes clear that the denial of class certification does not divest federal courts of jurisdiction under CAFA. That's what we have here, in effect, although they didn't seek certification, it was a default.
And the district court didn't even address the CAFA.
That's
point,
correct,
right?
Your Honor. I think it assumed, based on the sequence of events, which was an odd sequence of events, it assumed once it had rejected their class position that was out, and that's incorrect as a matter of circuit precedent.
Is United Steel now in question in light of Royal Canin and our recent decision of Falk applying it?
I think the answer is no, because we're looking at the amount of controversy, one, and two, we're looking at a failing on the plaintiff's part and not a voluntary act. Royal Canin addressed the federal question that was voluntarily withdrawn. The allegations were voluntarily withdrawn. This court in Falk extended that to the issue of diversity in class action cases, and it was also voluntary. But it made clear that United Steel wasn't within the scope of its holding, because United Steel is actually about a failing, not the plaintiff being the master of the complaint and choosing what to put forward and not. It's about an attempt that doesn't work. Here they had a deadline, they missed the deadline, they opposed the motion to strike their class allegations.
Could we construe plaintiff to have abandoned their CAFA allegations by not contesting the lateness of the filing?
That would be quite odd in my respectful opinion, because that's a default. That's a failing. I don't think it should be rewarded for that. Two, when they got our motion to strike their class allegations, they could have, I suppose, just moved for an amended complaint and withdrawn at that point. But they opposed at that point. They did say we don't have any intention to bring these, but they didn't withdraw their complaint and provide a new complaint that had those class allegations removed. In fact, that document does not exist. Today, the operative pleading in this case has class allegations.
Suppose we agree with you on traditional diversity jurisdiction and the failure to analyze, and we vacated and remanded. Wouldn't plaintiffs have the opportunity to amend their complaint and remove CAFA-related allegations to foreclose CAFA jurisdiction?
I'm out of time. May I answer?
Yes, please.
If the court agrees with us on traditional diversity jurisdiction, we wouldn't.
Well, I mean, I guess I to clarify, just agrees that the court should have undertaken a certain analysis that it didn't, and so our normal process would be to vacate and remand.
You could vacate and remand. I think it's too late for them to file an amended complaint voluntarily withdrawing them because they lost. That would be so contrived. So they had their chance. They missed the deadline. They lost the motion. I don't think Royal Canin has anything to do with that. And circuit precedent has a strong presumption in its favor, and that's the starting place. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of quick points. One would be that in Collins, I think it's an important point. This is the Judge Posner Seventh Circuit case. To point out the hypothetical that he posed in that case regarding a distributor who receives goods from out of state and then using new transport sends it on to end-use customers, that's our case. And it said there it would be intrastate. It's just interesting that my friend on the other side points that out, and it goes in our way. The commercial reality point, just to address very quickly, is simply that, yes, there are certain ways that that a business has to be run, I suppose, but you, in certain ways, you have to just pay overtime. I mean, what we're talking here isn't about not being able to run a business a certain way. It's about simply saying that when it's an entirely intrastate journey, that you simply have to pay overtime to your drivers for it, not that you can't do certain things. The Section 1 cases that opposing counsel relies on regarding the FAA Section 1 exemption, opposing counsel pointed out in its own briefs that this is a much broader and more capacious standard than the one that we're applying here, which is the exemption under the MCA. And this court's decision in Ortiz shows exactly that, that a person moving a box across one warehouse within the warehouse falls within the Section 1 exemption because it has an impact on commerce.
Counsel, that is not I want to get one question in before your time runs out. What do you make of opposing counsel's argument that they have presented evidence of the contracts, the supplier contracts through the declarations?
Well, what they have not presented and what they would need to have presented to get over this court's precedent in Southern Pack or Standard Oil would have been orders or something showing where the terminus was, where were goods to be delivered. None of the three things that the three deponents that they used in place of the contracts shows where any goods actually went in terms of a location.
Counsel, did you want to address the cross appeal at all?
Just in terms of the cross appeal, address your Honor's point, I think that if you were to agree, I mean, I don't agree on the diversity point, obviously. I think that what their assumptions are based on contradict this court's precedent in Ibarra, that they have to be reasonable. And to imagine that they're going to reach the amount of controversy for traditional diversity for $32,000 claims only by using $70,000 worth of fees each is not reasonable for the reasons we pointed out in the briefing. But if Your Honor were to say that there were, that the district court's reasoning needed to have included something more than it did, I would think that, yes, we would be able to amend the complaint to jettison
Why isn't there CAFA jurisdiction now on the basis of the cover sheet to your, you know, the $5 million amount in controversy that you alleged in the complaint? Why isn't that already alone enough?
Well, because in our view, Royal Canin, just like this court found in Falk, undoes United Steel. And in undoing United Steel, it also undoes the dicta or the very bit of superficial reasoning there that dealt with 1332d8 and how that operates.
I mean, I agree that Royal Canin set forth something that says that plaintiffs are the master of their complaint, but you haven't amended the complaint, and there's nothing that I see in the record that you abandoned the $5 million claim.
I think that's respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. I would say that in ER2, the court said that we conceded lack of jurisdiction and requested remand. That would be
CAFA jurisdiction?
Correct. And that would be, I can't imagine how that's functionally any different than an amendment.
But the concession, I mean, well, but it was based on a late notice. It wasn't, I don't know. I'm asking these questions just to probe it, but it seems a little bit of a stretch to me to say that you actually abandoned any CAFA claims because there's nothing in the record that says you did.
If you look at the briefing, which is in the record and appended to their SER that talks about that shows what the plaintiff submitted in response to the court's OSC regarding jurisdiction, all it was a description of how there isn't jurisdiction here. So I can't imagine anything more sort of straightforward as an abandonment or an attempt to modify the claims and parties, which Royal Canin says that now can be done well after a case is filed or after removal.
Is it possible for plaintiffs to recover on traditional diversity jurisdiction an amount of $75,000 or more?
Is it possible?
Yeah.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in order to get there, we would have to be able to get our fees that were dwarfed the recovery. And the case law that we pointed out showed that in cases where someone, let's say, settled $45 worth of claims for $10,000 and then sought to get fees of $45,000, the court said absolutely not, and that's a state law issue.
I mean, I didn't find that argument to be persuasive because I don't think that for diversity purposes – that were to look at the likelihood based on settlements between the parties, it's what is the possible range of damages for the amount in recovery? I mean, not sort of predicting in a crystal ball sense, might you settle with the opposing party? And it seemed to me the district court might have went astray by arguing that this is 100% when all we're supposed to look at is possible.
I think that it's remotely conceivable that a plaintiff could run the table and there could be a set of circumstances that would lead to $75,000 being met. But it's supposed to be, is this a reasonable assumption about attorney's fees? I mean, attorney's fees in California law does dictate how attorney's fees would operate here. It would be exceptionally unusual to be able to get the fees that would meet that amount based on these claims. For the reasons that we stated. I mean, is it conceivably possible? It's possible, but it's very unlikely.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Any additional?
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The